supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. In 1984, a family of three from Guatemala hid out in the First United Methodist Church of Germantown in order to avoid deportation. Now, two families have followed in their footsteps, moving into the same imposing stone building for the same reason. WHYY's Laura Benshoff has more on the growing number of immigrants taking sanctuary in Philadelphia.
Clive and Juanita Thompson are from Jamaica, but have lived in the U.S. for nearly 15 years. They came because they wanted to apply for asylum after gangs killed Juanita's brother. But they lost their case. When ICE told them it was time to buy a one-way plane ticket to Jamaica, they traded in the home they own in Cedarville, New Jersey, to live in a church theater dressing room in Philly. Juanita says the driving force to take sanctuary was their two youngest kids, who are both U.S. citizens.
Coming here, like, it was really hard. And I was so worried about the children because I know that if we didn't make this choice, they probably would have to maybe go into foster care, you know.
15-year-old Christine and 12-year-old Timothy Thompson also moved into the church. Family was also the reason 37-year-old Suyapa Reyes from Honduras and her four children moved into First Unitarian Methodist. When she lost her asylum case, she says an ICE agent told her that her deportation could mean leaving her two youngest kids, ages 10 months and 2 years, behind.
They told me that I had to leave the kids who were born here. For me, that was hard.
ICE spokesman Emilio Dabul said he couldn't comment on Reyes's case due to an ongoing legal proceeding. He did share a statement about the Thompsons, saying, quote, they are currently immigration fugitives and subject to arrest and removal from the country once encountered by ICE. These two families bring the total number of people in Philadelphia taking sanctuary up to 14. They and dozens of others in the U.S. attempting to avoid deportation this way rely on an ICE policy of not carrying out arrests in so-called sensitive locations. On Wednesday morning, Reverend Bob Coombe and the New Sanctuary Movement held a brief service to welcome the families.
In this moment, in this phase, we are all in sanctuary together.
The ceremony marked the beginning of their new lives, both more public and less free than their old ones. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
Registered Republicans and Democrats in Delaware are eligible to vote when polls open at 7 tomorrow morning in the state's primary elections. Joining me with perspective on the plays and players is WHYY's Mark Eichmann. Mark, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's go right to the high-profile race. Certainly, Democratic U.S. Senator Tom Carper has name recognition, having served, I believe, continuously for some 35 years, first in the House, and then, of course, as governor and now senator. And yet, there's a rival that's causing some interest.
Yeah, Tom Carper is going for his 14th straight election victory statewide races in Delaware. So name recognition is certainly not a problem for him. But Carrie Evelyn Harris has made a name for herself over the last, really over the last month especially, but throughout this summer as she's tried to push the Democratic Party, push voters a little bit more progressive than Carper has been. Carper, a very traditional centrist Democrat, and Harris is trying to pull Carper and pull the party, pull voters, more to the progressive side. And she's certainly gotten a lot of attention, a lot of national attention, especially after the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez upset win in New York earlier this summer. That kind of put a lot of eyes nationally on this race with thoughts of, can Harris do the same thing to Carper that Ocasio-Cortez accomplished in upsetting an incumbent.
Who is backing Harris in terms of the moneyed interests or the lobbying interests or the corporate interests?
Well, that's what Harris would point to and happily say, especially when it comes to corporate interests, no one. She's really made a point of her campaign to be sort of independent from any corporate sponsorship or corporate PAC money coming in. And she's pointed at Carper, who gets a lot of PAC money from corporate groups, from a variety of industries, pouring millions of dollars. He's raised over almost $3 million throughout this campaign. As of a couple of weeks ago, Harris had only brought in maybe about $60,000 from her grassroots supporters, most of that $20, $30 at a time. She does have support of progressive groups like the Progressive Democrats for Delaware.
How did she hold up in last month's debate with Carper?
She performed very well in the debate against Carper. And even just the fact that Carper debated her and agreed to debate is kind of a rare thing for a primary for U.S. Senate.
Speaking of rare things, what's the calculus behind a Thursday primary?
Yeah, it is rare, and it's something that they had to change. Delaware used to vote on a Saturday until about 20 years ago when that got changed to a Tuesday. And now, to really confuse things, this election by law should have been next Tuesday. But because that's the end of Rosh Hashanah, state lawmakers moved the date to tomorrow. And we'll see what kind of effect that has on turnout. I talked to the elections commissioner the other week, and she didn't expect it to have too much of an impact on turnout, that a lot of the campaigns had been including in their ad messaging that remember to vote on Thursday specifically.
Is that because turnout is fairly dismal to begin with on a primary?
Right. The last midterm election in 2014, Democratic voter turnout was 7%. Just 21,000 people, 22,000 people about turned out at the polls. So poor turnout is sort of par for the course here.
What are some other races of note?
The Delaware Attorney General, Matt Den, is not running for re-election. He's in his first term after two terms as Delaware's lieutenant governor. And in Delaware, the way voter registration is, there's so many more Democrats registered to vote here than Republicans. The Democratic primary is almost the vote. So there's four candidates running for Delaware Attorney General. A couple of them have come out of the Attorney General's office. Lucretia Roberts, a former Chief Deputy Attorney General. Also Kathy Jennings, she's a former Chief Deputy Attorney General and was state prosecutor under former Attorney General Beau Biden. Also running sort of on the progressive Democratic side is Chris Johnson. He's a former legal counsel for Governor Carney. He's been endorsed by the Progressive Democrats for Delaware. And then also running is Tim Mullaney, who's a former Dover police officer, also worked in Newcastle County government for then-executive Tom Gordon. And he also worked in the Department of Justice under Attorney General Beau Biden. So it's a crowded field for Attorney General. It's going to be interesting to see the way the votes shake out.
Do you have any reason to suspect it might be a long night in any of these races?
I don't expect to. Delaware traditionally has been very quick to call races and very quick to turn numbers around, in part because of Delaware's size. Even statewide races, the numbers come in relatively quickly. So I don't expect it to be a long night unless something weird happens with the Carper-Harris race, and that is much, much closer than people expect.
Well, I wish you a short night so you can get a good night's sleep so that if Kerry Harris defeats Tom Carper, we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
It will be very interesting for sure. Dave, thanks.
Thanks for joining us. WHYY's Mark Eichmann on Newsworks Tonight. Meanwhile, in a congressional race in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, a super PAC associated with Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan has put nearly $500,000 into TV ads attacking the Democratic candidate. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
Republicans are committed to hanging on to control of Congress, and a battleground seat like Pennsylvania's 1st District is bound to attract money from national party groups. The ad from the Congressional Leadership Fund, the Republican super PAC dedicated to holding the GOP majority, doesn't even mention the Republican incumbent, Brian Fitzpatrick. It goes after the Democratic challenger, Scott Wallace.
What's rich? Scott Wallace. He inherited $100 million, but Wallace repeatedly failed to pay his own taxes. Wallace was hit with a $70,000 lien for unpaid taxes.
As with most political ads, there's a little less than meets the ear here. The super PAC found one occasion when Wallace was 2 weeks late paying county and township taxes 6 years ago, and a more substantial lien the state of Maryland filed in 2007 for late taxes, interest, and penalties. Wallace has spent much of the past 20 years running his family foundation, spending a lot of time in Africa. Campaign spokeswoman Zoe Wilson-Meyer says the Republican ad is distorting what amounts to an oversight.
Scott received the notice of the tax while he was out of the country doing the work of his charity. And when he returned and found out he owed more in taxes, he paid them in full and the state waived all penalties. Scott Wallace has paid all of his taxes in full, period.
As a super PAC, the Congressional Leadership Fund can accept unlimited contributions under the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. The fund raised $51 million in the second quarter of this year. More than half of that came from Las Vegas casino magnate Sheldon Adelson. Will it make a difference in the race? J.D. Mullane is a veteran columnist for the Bucks County Courier-Times and Intelligencer newspapers. He says outside money is nothing new for this congressional seat.
It's a 50-50 district. People are dug in. It's not going to be the campaign, outside campaign ads that are going to make a difference here. It's going to be which candidate gets out, knocks on doors, and meets the most people.
The Congressional Leadership Fund has targeted up to $4 million this fall for the Bucks County race, and Communications Director Courtney Alexander says it's not just for advertising. She says the committee opened a field office in the district nearly a year ago to focus on grassroots campaigning.
So we talk about local issues. We're out knocking on doors. We're making phone calls. And our interns and volunteers are out every single day talking to folks in the first district.
While the Republican leadership PAC can bring in big money from national sources to help Fitzpatrick, so far Wallace has tapped his personal wealth for $5 million to fund his own campaign. He has a new ad.
I'm running against this guy, Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick.
He appears on camera to make his own case against Fitzpatrick.
Brian Fitzpatrick voted for the new tax law that gives most of the money to big corporations and the top 1%.
A message on the screen flashes that 83% of the tax breaks go to the top 1%. That figure comes from a Tax Policy Center analysis, and the number refers to the year 2027, after many middle-class tax breaks expire. Fitzpatrick has defended his vote on the tax overhaul, saying the national economy is stronger now because of the tax changes. So far, outside groups have spent about $1.1 million on the Bucks County race, with more than 90% of that going to attack Wallace. Robin Kolodny, who chairs the political science department at Temple University, isn't sure how much that will matter when some voters see the midterms as a referendum on President Trump.
To be blunt about it, it could be a lot of effort for nothing trying to focus on the reputation of the Democratic candidate when, in fact, if people are just interested in sending a message to the White House.
The Fitzpatrick-Wallace race isn't the only one getting national attention. Three other congressional contests in our region are also attracting outside spending. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Tourists from overseas are increasingly targeting Philadelphia as a go-to destination. That's good news for the region's residents and businesses, and specifically for the Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau, whose president and CEO Julie Coker Graham joins me now to make sense of the latest numbers. Julie, welcome to NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What numbers stand out in particular?
Oh, there's several. The one that I would definitely focus on is the fact that Philadelphia reached 648,000 overseas visitors coming to Philadelphia. And this is the third consecutive year that we have seen a positive increase. Also, too, the fact that folks are coming, staying in our city and also spending more overseas visitors. So our direct spending increase is up about 7.2% between 2016 and 2017.
Now, to be clear, Philadelphia specifically or the nine-county region?
Philadelphia specifically.
So does a closer look reveal primarily where these tourists are coming from? And are there any surprises?
There are, and I would say a lot of it has to do with the great work of the team in the office, as well as the seven international representation firms that we have around the country. The United Kingdom continues to be our number one market with over 100,000 visitors each year. That can certainly be attributed to the number of nonstop service flights that we have. China has moved into the number two spot. Germany continues to be our number three spot. But I would say what I'm probably most surprised about is South Korea. We did make a very concerted effort to do marketing programs there, as well as bring journalists over to Philadelphia to get a better feel for all the great things that we have to experience here in Philadelphia, and we can clearly see that those efforts are paying off.
You mentioned the United Kingdom, and I hate to bring politics into play, but of course, the image of the United States as we perceive it as Americans, we wonder if it's tarnished to an extent in overseas, particularly with friends who might have taken some umbrage at some of the statements and philosophies of the current administration. Has that negatively impacted, from your point of view, the challenge to bring visitors from not just the United Kingdom, but other destinations?
You know, I would definitely say it's something that we have all kept our eye on. We're very fortunate to have an advocate in U.S. Travel Association that's based in Washington, D.C. Roger Dow and his team do an excellent job trying to shape the messaging that comes out of Washington. One thing that we are all concerned about is that right now the United States is not getting their fair share of overseas visitors.
And that's defined
in terms of a country. So when you look at all of those that are traveling overseas, we as a country should be getting our fair share. And we are not, and that is not as high as we would like it.
Is there a counter argument? Are there any arguments against growing international tourism to a destination and specifically Philadelphia?
I don't believe so. Hospitality and tourism is the second largest employer in Philadelphia, only to education. And the average overseas visitor spends a little over $1,000 when they're here in our city.
Multiplied by how many visitors?
648,000 is what we had in 2017.
I don't have enough fingers and toes to do the math, but it sounds like a big number.
Definitely. And so what it does is it creates jobs, it generates taxes. So for the local economy, it definitely is beneficial. It definitely also creates cultural experiences, which can be two-way. So not only do the visitors that come get to enjoy the city, but also Philadelphia residents get to interact with overseas visitors, whether they're walking on the street or they're in restaurants or shopping. And so there's that cultural exchange that can also take place.
To what extent is marketing key to success? And I understand there's a relatively new campaign appropriately called Frankly Philadelphia.
Anytime that you have such a great product as the city of Philadelphia, you want to shout it to the world. So we're very fortunate. We just recently rolled out Frankly Philadelphia. It really speaks to the vibrancy and the genuine spirit of Philadelphia, of who we are.
A little bit of swagger?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we've got a lot to be proud of. And so this campaign, which I'm most excited about, is that we're very boastful about all the great things about Philadelphia, which is a little bit of a departure of how we've typically talked about ourselves.
Julie Coker Graham, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Julie Coker Graham is president and CEO of the Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau. The current Act Two Playhouse production of Neil Simon's play, Biloxi Blues, at its theater in Ambler, takes on special relevance because it opened last week, only days after Simon's death at the age of 91. For WHYY, Howard Shapiro offers this review.
The timing, of course, is simple coincidence. And the production is smooth, a sweet memorial, even though it never set out to be. The leader of Act Two Playhouse, Tony Braithwaite, has played characters in 9 of Neil Simon's plays during his career, and now he's directing Biloxi Blues. I asked Braithwaite what he's learned about Simon in all of this.
He says, and I see it, he doesn't write jokes. He writes people in situations that use humor to cope with the situation. And it's the foibles of the bourgeois, you know? So we know these people. We are these people. We get these people.
Biloxi Blues, which won Simon the Best Play Tony Award in 1985, is Simon at his comic purest, with characters we recognize instinctively because he draws them as stereotypes. And because, as Braithwaite notes, their reactions to much in life are funny. That sort of character doesn't always feel current nowadays in Simon's earlier urbane comedies that wowed Broadway in the 70s and 80s, like Barefoot in the Park or Plaza Suite, or even The Odd Couple. But Biloxi Blues is among his 3 later semi-autobiographical plays, all meatier and more introspective. Simon tells a story through the character Eugene, his dramatized alter ego, an 18-year-old raised in Brooklyn's Brighton Beach. He's being shipped to basic training in Biloxi, Mississippi, in wartime 1943. Eugene is played at Act Two by D.J. Gleason, who brings out the character's naivete and makes him a little impish and a lot adorable, the way Simon likely felt about the character and, by extension, himself. What I like best about Gleason isn't his narrative style. His character comes in and out of the action to comment directly to us. But the vulnerable way he fits into scenes with his platoon of newbies, played by performers who create a strong ensemble. For me, though, the best acting in the production comes from a force on stage named Andrew Chris, who is not playing a newly minted soldier. He's Merwin J. Toomey, the demeaning, threatening, industrial-strength authoritarian who's the basic training drill sergeant. Here he is, telling the anxious recruits that the only way to answer whether they're in attendance is by saying, ho.
Not yes, not here, not right, not sir, nor any other unacceptable form of reply except the aforementioned ho. Am I understood? Wachowski Joseph T.
Ho!
Selridge Roy W.
Ho!
Carney Donald J.
Ho!
Jerome Eugene M.
Ho!
Epstein Arnold B.
Ho, ho.
Like so many Neil Simon characters, the sergeant is written without nuance. But Chris gives us insights into the way this man thinks with his body language, expressive eyes, and menacing energy. Biloxi Blues itself has plenty of energy. Simon captures the different attitudes the young men had as World War II swept them into the period's military culture and into the unknown. The production at Act Two Playhouse does justice to it and to Neil Simon's memory. The show runs through September 30th. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.